Hey guys, how's things? Ah, well, good. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Oops, I forgot to write up a blog entry for today, didn't I? Today's show, Jonathan Marshall. I know how to spell it, I just don't know how to type very well. 12:02 Eastern, see? And, yeah, he wrote this thing at Consortium News that I want him to say out loud to you, basically, here. That's kind of the deal. A few more invites out. I guess we'll see. We got a couple hours to see whether maybe we can fill in the gap here. I got some things to talk with you about as well. Plenty of bad news to go over for you. Maybe a little bit of good news, although I couldn't think of what off the top of my head. Oh, Will. I forgot to call Will. Man, I got the attention deficit thing bad. I was in the middle of reading one of his articles, and I started reading another one of his articles, and or another article by somebody else, and then... Damn. All right, well... Time to switch back to more coffee instead of a limited amount. Yeah, Will Grigg. He wrote a bunch of great stuff. And, you know, it's really good about local police state issues here in the American police state. All right. Yeah, Jonathan Marshall, consortiumnews.com, rebuffing peace chances in Syria. That interview is coming up here in a little while. First, I want to talk with you. Whoa, wait a minute.
Oops. First time.
Jim Mikleshevsky, NBC News.
Alleged, that U.S. forces could be in a position where they would engage with combat on the ground there in Iraq. Now, we're not talking about committing large numbers of American forces to Iraq. That's out of the question. But for the first time, they're acknowledging that U.S. military forces could, in fact, be embedded with Iraqi forces on the ground during combat operations and engaged in combat. And you look at this situation. Where the U.S. military, Delta Force Commandos, accompanied Kurd forces in northern Iraq just this past weekend when one U.S. soldier, or this past week, when one U.S. soldier, Delta Force Commando, was killed in that operation. And that's what they're talking about. And to this day, there are some within the Pentagon and administration that deny that that was in a combat operation. Yet today, in testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee, Secretary Carter said that was combat, Andrea.
What a mess. Isn't that funny? You're going to have, I guess, already do have, you know, I suppose Rangers, right? You have Delta and SEALs in bed with them like that? They run their own games, but I guess, well, I'm assuming here, I don't know for sure, but assume, put the Rangers in there to lead the, what's left of the Iraqi army and their battalions, their, you know, so-called Golden Brigade and all this stuff. But they're fighting side by side with Asaib al-Ahaq and the Bada Brigade and Khatib Hezbollah and the Mahdi Army. And all of these Shiite militias are all run by Iranians. They're Green Berets embedded and leading. Especially the Bada Brigade is the biggest and most powerful one of those, and the most Iranian controlled of them all. So, I guess you could argue that, well, I guess peace is going to break out any time now. And everybody sees what great allies the Iranians are. More likely, it's the same thing as flying in the same skies over Syria. It could cause a war. Hey, who do you think you are trying to fight on the same side of this war as us? Our guys will say as they start bombing the Iranian militias that they put in power there and who outnumber the so-called Iraqi army by who knows how many to one. And by the way, what the hell is the Iraqi army other than the Bada Brigade anyway? Were you guys under the impression that there was an Iraqi army that was separate from the Bada Brigade? I mean, I know Maliki did what he could to make the government his own during his time, but that's where they got him all from. So, anyway, just further escalation. And then, so I have my own clip here of John McCain. How long is this damn thing here? It's, oh, it's way too long. I guess I'll wait till the next segment. Yeah, well, he starts with Guantanamo. I'm going to go ahead and play this clip.
The second issue I want to mention to you is Guantanamo. I understand that the president has said many numerous occasions that one of his objections...
Oh, hell, did I not mention that this is John McCain questioning the Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, this morning, just now, before the show?
This is Guantanamo. You and the president's top aide came to my office and said you were going to give me a plan. I've always favored closing Guantanamo for a whole variety of reasons, and yet we still haven't got a plan from you. In fact, not only not a plan, until I asked you about it specifically, there was no communication. After coming to my office and saying that you're going to give me that plan, and I said we needed it before we marked up the defense authorization bill. We got nothing, not an update, not a briefing on what was going on. So we put in the language in Guantanamo, and the president then voices his strong objection to Guantanamo. Finally.
Man, what is that? There's only two answers, right? Either the president really does not want to close Guantanamo, or the Secretary of Defense and the Army and Marine Corps just refuse to carry out his orders. Which is it? Those are your choices. I prefer the first answer. I think the first answer is the much more credible answer. Barack Obama has done nothing to push the closure of Guantanamo Bay. And here's the thing about it. John McCain has staked out his position as the ultimate hawk to the right of everyone on everything foreign policy. So, if the president needs conservative credentials to back up his decision to close Guantanamo, no problem. Not only can he quote George W. Bush and Colin Powell and a bunch of nobodies from a long time ago, he can quote the current head of the Armed Services Committee, his enemy, McCain. Our enemy, McCain. And say, look, even McCain says we gotta close it. So I am sending the Secretary of Defense over there to work this out and get this thing closed now. That's all he has to do. He's got his entire right-wing flank covered. All he has to do is say, Democrats in the House, in the Senate, I need you all on board for this. We got the, you know, key Republicans on board, and we're going to close the goddamn commie prison down there at Guantanamo Bay. And he just won't do it. He just won't do it. John McCain, here, look, I mean, what is the absurdity of this? John McCain saying to the Secretary of Defense, hey man, I thought we were closing Guantanamo. What the hell do I gotta do to get an answer from you about what we're doing about that? Are we doing something or not? I haven't even heard from you on it. Barack Obama. Why? That's funny because I seem to remember him saying that was why he was running for president to close that damn thing. And, you know, it was in the Washington Post back in 2009 that he made no effort whatsoever to push the Congress. It's just a talking point for your imagination. No real move by the president to close it. Not ever. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhortonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottWhortonShow. And thanks, y'all. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. And then, I got a story or two to tell you, but here, first this.
This issue of whether we are protecting those people who we are asking to fight against Bashar Assad and ISIS. Isn't it true that we've dropped munitions, General Dunford, to a group of people who we are supporting in Syria?
It is true, Senator.
It is true. And yet, are we going to protect them from Russian air attacks?
Senator, we have the authority, we have the capability, and we have options to defend the forces that we've...
But is it true that the Russians are already attacking them?
The ones we have trained, they
I'm not asking the ones we trained, the ones we dropped munitions to.
No, the Russians have not attacked the ones we've dropped munitions to, Senator.
They have not?
No, Chairman.
And they have not?
To make sure that you and I are speaking to the same group, the group I'm referring to is what's known as the Syrian Arab Coalition. They're operating in the northeast part of the country, north of Raqqa, and we recently provided resupply to those individuals, ammunition.
And if they're attacked by the Russians, we'll defend them.
Senator, we have the capability to do that, and we'd provide options. I can't answer that question.
They'd be interested. They'd be interested in knowing. I think if we're going to give them equipment and ask them to fight, and then they're going to be, we can't answer to them whether we're going to protect them or not. I think it's a degree of immorality. Anyway.
Yeah, well, so there you go. That's as simple as that, right? And, of course, the thing is about it is he's right. This whole thing, hey, as I've said for 4 years, although I don't say this often enough, but I have said it all along, the whole thing is a one big great Bay of Pigs in the desert, just like in 1991. And I'm not saying I would have favored the invasion of Cuba any more than... Bush Sr.'s encouraging of the Shia and Kurds to rise up against Saddam, or encouraging of these Al-Qaeda guys to fight against Assad. They apparently only kind of half-ass mean it. They're willing to coordinate enough money and guns for the Bin Ladenites to keep the war going, but not win. I don't know, man. I'm sure it changes on a day-to-day basis or whatever, but there's a quote or two of John Brennan, the head of the CIA, saying, look, it's not in our interest to have a full de-Bothification and abolition of the Syrian state here. I mean, that could get hairy, right? Oh, yeah. Oh, you thought this through finally, huh? What's it going to look like after the de-Bothification? It'll look like the last 5 years are simply a prelude to the slaughter is what it'll look like. But anyway, John McCain, so here we are at the point now, more than halfway through 2015. Love October in Austin. More than halfway through 2015 here, the Russians have called the Americans bluff. All right, that's it. This is a big Bay of Pigs failure, half-assed mission thing, and you are not going to overthrow Havana, Damascus. And they've moved their pieces onto the table now. And so what's John McCain's only answer? Not, well, crap, I guess our bluff has been called. But what in the world is it going to take for the Pentagon to stop being such sissies and start shooting down Russian jets over Syria? If Russian jets bomb CIA and DOD-backed jihadists in Syria, then what are you going to do about it, General? And I guess that's the new chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff is saying, well, you know, I could provide options to the president, but I've, you know, what do you want me to tell you? But this is what I told you back in 2007, 2008. John McCain, and I never supported Obama. I always warned you against Obama. Go back and check the record. Always from the first day I ever heard of him. In fact, I could prove that somewhere. I have the clip of me from the first day I ever heard of him on the Chaos Report in 2007. Saying, who the hell is this guy? I already hate him. This TV told me to like him. I never supported him. I did say, on the other hand, that I would sort of understand if people voted for him just in self-defense, because John McCain certainly means to start a war with Russia over whatever excuse he can, because he's stupid and because he's a madman and because he'll never measure up to his father or grandfather. He's like George W. Bush, except without the happiness. He's worse. He's got a total pathology thing going on there. Crazy, crazy thing in his brain. And here he is saying, well, geez, in essence, geez, if I was the president, I would be in an air war with Russia over Syria right now. What the hell are we waiting for? I mean, I know it sounds crazy, but you heard what he said. It's immoral not to arm people who we don't mean to protect, but to not protect the people we arm. Nuclear war. Seriously, you're going to give up? Are you willing to give up your hometown in order to enforce a regime change for Al-Qaeda in Syria? And don't give me this crap about mythical moderates. They're all a bunch of Al-Qaeda guys. The Al-Qaeda and ISIS, which ISIS is just a split off. They still claim bin Laden, just not Zawahiri. It's the same damn thing. It's Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Zarqawi's guys. Those groups dominate the field. Any help America gives to any so-called Free Syrian Army brigades is mostly just them fencing weapons for Al-Qaeda. That's all it is. And any gains that they actually make against the Assad regime ultimately are just in favor of al-Nusra and the Islamic State. Are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria by supporting al-Qaeda's allies in Syria? Yes. That's right, Hillary.
Clicked on the thing, it's supposed to work, but I guess not.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
There, see? That was back in 2012. Of course.
May I, on the two points you raised, just take a moment. First of all, I don't mean to be coy about the ship sailing, and I know things are in the newspaper. I'm just going to tell you where I'm coming from on that. It has nothing.
Yeah, never mind. He's asking about something else. But, yeah, anyway, there you go. Good for you, America, for not electing John McCain in 2008. We'd all be dead right now, all of us. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
That's Michael Gerson?
I had no idea. That's funny. All right. Well, anyway. Hey, how are you guys doing? Sorry. I have the Andrea Mitchell Greenspan show on out of the left corner of my eyeball here, and it was noticing a funny thing. Yeah, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, join up the chat room with the boys. Hey, guys, how are you guys doing and things? ScottHorton.org/chat. That's all you need is a plain old browser window, ScottHorton.org/chat. Fake name and a CAPTCHA, and you're in. If you use any external type chatting application, it's an IRC free node chat. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. yeah, there you go. All right, Will can't do the show. Things came up. So that's unfortunate. However, what's fortunate is that Jonathan Marshall is going to be on the show here in a little while. And he wrote a great thing. So when he talks about it, that also is going to be great. Yeah. Tonight. Tonight, Jeff Tucker and I will host Eye on the Empire on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire on Liberty.me. Now, we were supposed to do the show last week, but Tucker was in court. But anyway, should be ready tonight. And so instead of going on the opposite week from Sheldon and Lucy, we're now coming on right after them. So Sheldon Richman and Lucy Steigerwald have a show that comes on tonight at, I think, 7. No, at 8 Eastern. And we come on at 9 Eastern. Right after them. So that should be a lot of fun, right? My plan is for it to be a lot of fun. Mostly what it's going to be is Jeff talking about how much he doesn't like going to court. And how other people also shouldn't have to go to court. This sucks. I like Jeff Tucker. He's funny. So, yeah, man, that'd be good. Eye on the Empire. Mostly we talk about foreign policy on that show. We named it in honor of the great Alan Bock. That was his column at antiwar.com if you want to go back and learn a lot of great stuff. Eye on the Empire was his column there. That's tonight at 9 Eastern, right after Sheldon and Lucy at liberty.me. Liberty.me. Okay. Let me make sure I got all the... Yeah, man. There's so much to cover, and I'm not sure in what order. Ashton Carter on the moderates. I guess my only comment, as long as we're still on Syria here for a minute before we get back to it later. To listen to Ashton Carter, the Secretary of Defense, muddle through his explanation of how it is supposedly that we're supporting some moderates but not other moderates, and the DOD, well, we're supporting the moderates who were fighting ISIS, even though that's not really happening, but then some other agency that we've never heard of may or may not be backing fighters that are fighting Assad. And then, yes, it's true that al-Nusra and ISIS are the two strongest factions that are fighting Assad. But, you know, they're real mean guys. And, you know, they engage in atrocities that are atrocious, don't you know? And so, but the moderates that we're backing, they don't do those terrible things. And so they deserve our support. I had the clip because I deleted it because I was in a hurry at the start of the show and I just wanted to get the McCain on Gitmo thing. But anyway, you could watch it. It's on C-SPAN 3 this morning. It's the Armed Services Committee hearing from this morning. You can watch it. And just to watch him muddle through his explanation of how America is muddling through this policy. And I'm not saying it's all accidental or whatever. I'm saying the policy is to muddle. This is what they've got and this is what they're doing. And yeah, they're risking war with Russia. And I would say, I'm not predicting one or whatever. I don't think I don't have a bad feeling about this, that it's going to escalate that far. But we'd all be stupid to pretend like, oh, geez, yeah, no, Russia backing Assad and us trying to overthrow him in the same war, supporting different factions on the ground, government and non-government forces, with jet fighters in the air, carving out space, claiming at sometimes to be bombing the same enemies and sometimes not. The whole thing is a damn Gordian knot, or some kind of knot. Maybe more of a fisherman's knot. Anyway, I don't like it. And, you know, I don't know. If I was president, I would give a speech that says, look, okay, if anybody shoots me, for the record, obviously the Army and the CIA did it, okay? Because I'm hereby ordering them to come home. And I don't care if you kill me because, hey, I'm going down in history as the president who gave the speech, who gave the orders publicly to move the troops to bring the empire home. Enough. You know what you would do? I'd be happy to get shot by an army sniper if I was the president. And I tried to end their evil empire and called it such to their face. You know, this president, if I was him, I would just start doing the right thing. And he knows what the right thing is. Unlike John McCain, the madman, Barack Obama knows exactly what the right thing is as he does the wrong thing time after time after time. He hasn't gotten us into nuclear war with Russia like McCain would have by now. But still, he's pretty damned bad. But, you know, just like on closing Guantanamo, just like on ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, he sure knows all the right things to say he's doing. Protecting whistleblowers, protecting your privacy, stopping them dang terrorists for you. Ending the wars that you don't want to fight. Anyway, to watch Ashton Carter muddle through his explanation of the policy was a perfect metaphor for the policy itself. And, you know, it's, I don't know, how about unfair to the victims of it? That Americans don't even care. It's not that we really control our government, although kind of, sort of. You know, if we had real unanimity in this country, if people were anti-war, and they are in majorities, but if they were in super majorities, and if they really meant it, like it was the top of their priority, then the empire would be gone. That much is true, you know? But we don't really control it, but it seems like we at least owe these people our attention. And I don't mean in a warmongering way, which is unfortunately how it always turned. But it does seem kind of unfair to them that our government ruins their societies all day long, and then they do nothing but accuse themselves of not doing enough to help and get away with that, and then just continue to escalate and on down the line. And literally, the official line of our government now is, yes, we are backing the allies of Al-Qaeda against Al-Qaeda's enemy, but so we're only backing the moderate ones who... What? They don't even finish the sentence. They just would have you believe that someday are going to beat Assad and the Ba'athist army and Hezbollah and Iranian special forces helping out, backed now outright by Russian air power and al-Nusra and the Islamic State, and create, you know, a Syrian moderate secular democracy. Is that what you believe? That's what they say they're doing.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I like being a radio show, man. It's pretty good. Sorry I missed yesterday. I had some things to do. But anyway, now I'm back. And here in just a little while, I'm going to have Jonathan Marshall on to talk about Syria. He wrote this great thing at Consortium News I'm going to have you look at. Man, I got to tell you about Yemen. Reuters, Yemen hospital hit by Saudi-led airstrike. Doctors Without Borders. Medicines Sans Frontiers. This time bombed by America and Saudi. Who picked the target? Who picked the target? Obama picked it. The Democrats. A Yemeni hospital run by medical aid group Medicines Sans Frontiers was bombed in a Saudi-led airstrike, wrecking the facility and wounding several people, the hospital director said on Tuesday. Saudi-led Arab coalition intervened in Yemen's civil war in March to try to restore its government after its toppling by Houthi forces. But the civilian death toll has escalated since then, alarming the United Nations and human rights groups. What an interesting sentence. The MSF facility in Sada in North Yemen was hit by several airstrikes last night with patients and staff inside the facility, Medicine Sans Frontiers said in a tweet. Yemen state news agency Saba, run by the Iran-allied Houthis, whom the Arab coalition is fighting, quoted the Hedin hospital director saying several people were injured in the attack, which occurred in Houthi-controlled North Yemen. The air raids resulted in the destruction of the entire hospital with all that was inside, devices and medical supplies, and the moderate wounding of several people, Ali Mughli said. Saba said other airstrikes hit a nearby girls' school and damaged several civilian homes. It's not immediately possible to confirm that report, and a coalition spokesman was not immediately available for comment. And then they just remind us about the attack in Afghanistan, which, by the way, in case you missed it, they're on version number 6 or 7 now about why they attacked the Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan. And their latest version is, well, we thought that there was a Pakistani spy in there, so that's why we did it. They think that that's an excuse to attack a hospital and burn the patients alive in their beds, many of whom were civilian victims of the war. And there was no Pakistani spy, no evidence that there ever was. But that's their excuse. Not, oops, somehow there was a miscommunication between the Afghans and the Americans. Just give us some fake-ass excuse. Are they going to justify it by saying they were trying to kill one guy? When it happened, I said, geez, I don't know, man. They had to have known it was a hospital. It's possible that they were actually just, they deliberately did it. It was an assassination, a decapitation strike. One guy in there, one cell phone SIM card in there that thereafter. And that's their excuse. Who even knows if it's true, right? But they think that that's their excuse. Yes, we bombed the Doctors Without Borders hospital full of civilians and, you know, doctors. Because we're trying to assassinate somebody. Can't believe you have a problem with that. And the Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times have both reported and elaborated on, and there should be a lot better reporting on this. You know, Mark Perry's done some reporting on it as well. interviewed him on the show about it. The Americans are picking the targets. They're running this war. They're refueling the Saudi planes in the air. They are entering the GPS coordinates into the Saudi pilots' planes. They're probably loading the bombs on them, too. It's America's war in Yemen against a civilian population, the poorest country in the Middle East. It's funny, when you hear somebody say that, when I hear somebody say that, I think, Jesus, there's the poorest country in the Middle East? I'm scratching my head going, huh, how do you even rank them, right? I guess they're very rich countries in the Middle East. Yemen's the poorest. And I'm sorry I haven't done the research yet. I still have the tabs all here. I did do a lot of reading over the weekend of the drone papers. We're going to talk about that later. I just haven't done the homework yet, but I interviewed that lady, Martha Mundi, and she had written all about in the past, and she sent me the links and stuff. She had written in the past about why it is that Yemen is so dependent on their imports. It's because IMF, World Bank loans, and property seizures and screw jobs from previous history has left them wholly dependent on imports. Meanwhile, they've been under a blockade for 7.5 months. So what does that tell you? And Human Rights Watch and Amnesty and Oxfam and all of them are saying, you know, famine, malnutrition, starvation, crisis, emergency. It's a big part of the reason that the American government is like this, that the American people won't stop them from being like this, is because the American people just couldn't believe it. This is exactly the kind of stuff that we hear as war propaganda about other countries and why we have to attack them, right? If right now all of a sudden the establishment decided to pivot and turn on their enemies, the Saudis, this would be the perfect case for why we gotta kill them. Just look at the Saudi aggression against Yemen. And this is barbarism. This is a war against children by the hundreds of thousands, millions. This must stop immediately or we'll bomb Riyadh. Except it's America doing it. So it's fine. Don't pay any attention to it. You know, I ended the show last Friday with the CNN story about this little boy who had died from shrapnel. And, of course, in that story, the only reason they published it, as pointed out on Twitter, was because the parents, at least supposedly, blame the Houthis. There's still American weapons on all sides of the fight in Yemen, no doubt about that. The Houthis have taken over the government, taken over the army. That's all American-supplied weapons. American-bought. And anyway, the Houthis are in a war because America and Saudi have attacked them. I suppose it's possible that the Houthis deliberately targeted this kid, but, you know, I'm not saying it's okay to fire artillery blindly or anything like that either, but I'm just saying, let's not ignore the context. That's what CNN would do. They would say, oh, look at this poor murdered kid, and then they would give you a reason to believe that that's why it's good that we're at war against these horrible Houthis. When it's the Americans and the Saudis are the bad guys in this, there's just no question. That's why it goes on, because Americans just couldn't believe it. Barack Obama acting as cruelly as George Bush on his worst day? I mean, hell, I guess most people just kind of think of Bush as too stupid to, even when he was trying to mean well, whatever. I mean, I tend to think of him as a much more petty and cruel and vindictive little son of a bitch, but, you know. I mean, what is Barack Obama doing here? Think he doesn't know what's going on here? You think he can't order the American army to stop helping the Saudis wage this war? Oh, but no, Scott, you don't understand. You got to work within the system or else you lose all influence. And so, but who's the empire and who's the satellite here? America owns the war in Yemen. Same as they own the war in Somalia. Nobody even talks about the war in Somalia at all. And the only reason the African Union is occupying that place is because America's paying for the whole damn thing. And the only reason in hell, and America's behind it in the first place. Read Rob Prince at FPIF.org. Rob Prince, FPIF.org, Somalia, WikiLeaks. There's your keywords. Somalia, WikiLeaks, Rob Prince. And there's where America told Meles Zenawi, the dictator of Ethiopia, you will invade Somalia for us now. And he went, okay, okay. And went in there and killed them all and raped and murdered the women and children and starved 500,000 children to death. 600,000. That's according to America and America and UK-backed NGO. FuseNet, the famine early warning system. Same thing.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our guest today is Jonathan Marshall. He is an independent researcher living in California, and he writes at consortiumnews.com. I think we're running this one today at antiwar.com, right? Or maybe tomorrow. Or maybe yesterday. Yeah, I think it was yesterday we ran this at antiwar.com. Rebuffing Peace Chances in Syria. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hi, fine, thanks.
Good. Happy to have you on the show here. A very good piece, very important piece. And, you know, I guess we want to tell the whole story of this sort of pseudo half-assed regime change in Syria. We could go back even to the Iraq War days, 2006 and 7, and the redirection, all that, if you want to. But this article starts off at least with post-Arab Spring Syria policy. Hey, here's a protest movement. Let's hijack it and see what we can do with it. So you can start your story wherever you want, but I love the way you go through here and fail to forget any of the chances that America and its allies have had to end the conflict with a resolution that actually could have been satisfactory to at least the claimed aims and goals of all sides.
Sure. Scott, this is actually kind of my third big historical survey, and I did it partly because I was so dissatisfied with the general media coverage I was seeing out there, and I knew that the kind of pronouncements we get from the White House and State Department were not trustworthy. So I figured I need to find out what really happened. And the first piece I looked at, well before this whole civil war started, how the Assad regime had tried strenuously to make a deal with the United States, even with Israel, a peace agreement. And unfortunately, under the Bush-Cheney government, they were so intent on regime change all through the Middle East. They had this idea which went back to some plans from even the 1990s about how Arab governments all over the Middle East would be overthrown to help Israel come out supreme in the region. And so Assad's peace efforts were continuously rebuffed. Even the Israeli government was open to negotiating, and Cheney called a halt to it. It's really quite amazing.
That was under Ehud Olmert and his government, right?
Yes, Olmert was trying. And then when Netanyahu got in, I think around 2009, then, of course, all the peace chances just evaporated. He had zero interest in peace. Then Obama engaged in some negotiations. But in early 2011, as I think your audience knows, as part of the Arab Spring, protests started forming. And Syria was quite weak at the time because of extraordinary multi-year famine that had driven hundreds of thousands of people off the farms and into cities. And because of their the U.S. economic embargo and other things, it was very tough for the Syrian government to manage, on top of which they faced the extraordinary economic burden created by the United States with the war in Iraq, which had sent 1 or 2 million Iraqis abroad as refugees. Many of them had gone to Syria. So they were just staggering under the weight of the Iraqi refugees, their rural refugees who were fleeing famine. When the Arab Spring started, it's kind of widely assumed that Assad just began mass murder of his citizens. And that simply isn't the case. As I showed in a previous article, he made extensive overtures, and the opposition turned violent very quickly. They started shooting and killing police and other security officials in large numbers. So that almost from the beginning, this was a genuine two-sided armed conflict, not a one-sided government mass murder. By August, literally just a few months after the conflict started, President Obama made one of his classic foreign policy mistakes, and he insisted that the Assad regime must go. Well, that, in this day and age, is essentially for any leader to go, that's signing their death warrant. We saw that happened with Gaddafi. Leaders like that who are authoritarian have no place to go. The International Criminal Court will hunt them down. So we gave Assad no reason to end the conflict. And what I show in this new piece is that because of the insistence on regime change, the United States from the beginning has refused to engage in international negotiation that might have brought this conflict to an end. And some of those negotiations started under United Nations auspices in 2012. And Russia was all involved. And again, the United States simply under with Secretary of State Clinton leading the way, said no negotiations with Assad. Well, you know, we would all love to negotiate just with ourselves and our friends. Wouldn't that be a great world if that's all we had to do? Imagine if you could negotiate a pay increase on your job just by talking to your spouse. Well, that would be great, too. That's not the way the world works. And so as I show in the piece, we've systematically lost opportunities for peace. Now that the United States is finally appears to be willing to negotiate with Assad, the opposition is overwhelmingly turned into a hardline extremist Islamist opposition that has no interest in peace. So we may have, I hope not, but we may have lost for good the opportunity to bring the settlement to a peaceful conclusion.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, now, so this is goes right to one of the things that I really liked about this is the way that you go through and talk about the different leaders that were created, basically the Friends of Syria governments in exile and all of this, and the different ones that were tried. But to my recollection, each time they did create one of those, the first thing they did was turn around and endorse the al-Nusra Front, because that was the, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the Butcher of New York. And it was their only desperate stab at credibility that they have. Yes, we're the sock puppets of Hillary Clinton, but we love you real frontline fighters out there getting the work done. We're with you kind of thing. And they were rejected anyway, but that was the best chance they had at credibility. So I wonder who, you know, which mythical moderates were there ever to negotiate with on the jihadi side, the Saudi American Turkish backed bin Ladenite side.
Not many. I mean, I think in fairness, there were in 2011 a fair number of non-Islamist opponents of the government. But those groups typically are the least effective. Often they have people who are in exile abroad. They're just not the kind of battle-hardened people who win wars. The sad thing is civil war is a kind of Darwinian process. It selects the most ruthless, toughest, militant least compromising people. That's why you don't want to end up in a civil war. That's not a good place to develop democracy. And every time we do regime change, thinking that that's going to bring about a more humane, liberal, humanitarian, democratic order, it's a fantasy, because violent regime change selects in favor of the people who are most ruthless, have the most guns, and are most willing to kill indiscriminately. And so the kind of nice mythical moderates that we have been going after were just swamped by the much battle-hardened Al-Qaeda and now Islamic Front, I mean Islamic State extremists. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure we've all read about some of the handful of political moderates who the CIA trained or the military trained, who were then sent into battle and instantly handed over all of their weapons, either to al-Nusra or to the Islamic State. It's it would be a funny joke if it weren't so tragic.
Yep. All right. Well, we're about to have to take this break. But when we get back, we'll talk more about this demand that the president has repeated as recently as, I guess, a month ago now, that Assad must step aside, and what all he means by that, and especially now that the Russians have intervened to the degree that they've intervened, and where we're at in this whole botched Bay of Pigs in Syria. It's Jonathan Marshall from ConsortiumNews.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Jonathan Marshall. He writes for ConsortiumNews.com. This piece is Rebuffing Peace Chances in Syria. Yeah, years and years now of rebuffing peace chances in Syria. And yet we, I don't know if there is a policy or what exactly. Obama said just, I think, 4 or 5 weeks ago, Assad must go. Still, that's the policy. And that was the first time he had said that in years, reaffirming that that was the policy. But then John Brennan has said, yeah, I think maybe somebody around here learned the lesson, head of the CIA, that we don't really want to necessarily change the entire regime in Damascus into an Al-Qaeda one, because that might be ugly and the start of new bad things. So that makes sense. And the news is saying that, hey, they've been holding preliminary talks toward the holding of talks in Vienna, and AP just broke on Twitter that they're going to invite Iran, and that it's America, Saudi, Turkey, Russia, and Iran, no Syrians, I guess, invited. But anyway, you know, I don't know. Do you have any idea what the hell America's Syria policy is, Jonathan Marshall?
Rather pathetic, but I don't think the administration knows either. There was that famous little brouhaha a few months ago where the White House spokesman was criticizing all those who had demanded that the U.S. start training these various anti-regime moderates. And of course, when that turned out not to work, the spokesman said, well, Obama was against it. Even though he instituted the policy, it was like he was against it before he was for it. Made no sense at all. The buck obviously didn't stop in the White House there.
Yeah.
I think that, as so often happens, there's a rash policy. Remember, he drew the line in the sand on chemical weapons, and he insisted that the precondition was that Assad must go. Then reality sets in, and he realizes things are a lot more complicated. the people opposing Assad may be even worse than Assad. And if we insist on Assad going before we talk, there will be no talks. And then he's stuck trying to find a face-saving way out. Meantime, hardline neoconservatives are constantly badgering this administration to do more, to put troops on the ground, to create no-fly zones, to start a new Cold War with Russia. And so he flails around. The good news is that 4 years too late, this administration does seem to be willing to include Assad in negotiations for a transition government. They do still want him out in the long run. And I think, realistically, everyone, including Russia, understands that Assad isn't here for the long run. Interestingly, you know, the mass media keep pretending that Russia insists that Assad must stay. They've never insisted that Assad must stay. They've simply insisted that Assad be part of the process and that the Syrian people make the final decision of who their leader is. If you think about it, that's the classic principle of self-determination that the U.S. always asserts as the proper policy. Not that we follow it very often, but we've always insisted that self-determination is the right policy. We have the curious role reversal that Russia, throughout this conflict, has been enunciating the policy of self-determination. And the U.S. and its allies, such nice democracies as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, have been insisting that, no, Syrian people can't decide. We have to decide for them and put in some anti-regime force. The concern I have is that, well, it's great to see these negotiations getting off to a tentative start with all the right external parties. Who, as you were kind of joking, Scott, who is there on the Syrian side? The problem now is that after several years of extraordinarily violent civil war, the only people left opposing the Assad government are extreme Islamist fundamentalists who do not want peace. So I think all these foreign powers can talk all they want, but it's going to be very, very hard to put any pieces back together again after they've smashed Syria into a million parts.
Well, I mean, the thing is, the answer is simple. It's just politically impossible. And I'm not saying this is one I favor, but I'm just saying from the imperial side, what makes perfect sense is the Americans agreeing with the Iranians and Hezbollah and Russia and the Baathist minority and to a great degree Sunni-backed government in Damascus, that they will, in fact, no lion, pull all their support for the jihadists and proceed to sit back and watch as the Syrian army crushes the Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front and reestablishes the Syrian state to its old borders and then holds some elections and whatever. But there's no Nusra because there's no more Saudi, Qatari, Turkish, Israeli, American support for them.
You may be a little bit too sanguine about how quickly the Islamists would die out. I think at this point, they have some independent sources of income, including oil in both Syria and Iraq. They also will continue to have private support in the Sunni world that's very difficult to shut off completely. They've got captured weapons. This is a genie that's hard to put back in the bottle this late in the game.
Well, there are a lot of them, but as far as, you know, the Islamic State used to be a group. Now it's a place. It could be turned back into a group fairly easily. You know, Eric Margolyes jokes that the Turkish police could sack Mosul. You know, you wouldn't even need the Turkish army to invade. Just send in the gendarmes and the war be over in a week and a half.
Boy, I think that's the kind of hubris we got into when Obama, a couple of years ago, talked about the Islamic State being kind of a non-entity, and it's grown hugely since then. I just, you know, time will tell. I don't think it'll be that simple. I think the other problem is the only way your scenario would work is if this entire international community continued giving very large amounts of aid to Assad. Given his record, that's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen on a one-sided basis. that...
Well, it wouldn't take anybody more than the Russians. I mean, really, my proposal, even as horrible as it is, still only has America butting out, but enforcing the butting out of our allies, too, basically.
How do we do that? Saudi Arabia has made it very clear that it's willing to go its own way. And given the financial resources it has and its proximity to that theater, we don't have the capability of enforcing an arms embargo. The best thing we can do is find some kind of agreement that makes Saudi Arabia buy into it.
Yeah.
And
possibly. Although then again, America has a lot of carrots that they could threaten to pull from the Saudis. You know, they can talk real big about what they're going to be able to do, what they could do without us, but we haven't seen them try it yet. We've only seen them try it with American cooperation all along, pretty much, right?
Right. I think one of the big failures of the Obama administration was buying Saudi support for the Iran nuclear deal, which I think was, by the way, a very good deal. But I'm afraid that the Obama administration gave Saudi Arabia a blank check in return for supporting that deal. One part of the blank check went to Yemen, where, as you well know, the U.S. is still supporting Saudi aggression throughout Yemen at huge civilian expense. And the other part of the blank check, or one of the other parts, is going to Syria, where we basically are not doing much to block continued Saudi aid to Islamists in Syria.
Yep.
And we're paying a huge, you know, where civilians are paying a huge price. And given that we keep intervening in these countries in the name of humanitarian intervention, it's a very cruel irony indeed.
Yeah. The Israelis and the Saudis both you know, the nuclear deal has hurt our feelings and we need to be... you know, comforted by give us more billions of dollars and blank checks and bombs and aggressive war and a blank check to treat Al-Qaeda guys in our hospitals and God knows what madness so that we can help secure their safety by double extra assuring the civilian nature of the Iranian nuclear program, huh? Wow.
You know, Obama totally muddled his message. He should have said, this is one of the toughest nuclear agreements ever devised in history, you know, with tougher sanctions and inspections than almost anything else we've ever seen. This will directly improve the security of both Israel and Saudi Arabia. No way are we going to then have to pay an additional price on top of that. You guys should be thanking us, not the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, listen, I've already kept you over the time, but I really appreciate this article, and I really appreciate you coming back on the show, Jonathan.
Thanks, Scott. Bye-bye.
Good stuff. All right, y'all. That is Jonathan Marshall. He's at consortiumnews.com, rebuffing peace chances in Syria. It's a really good one. Go back and read it. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, y'all, how's it going? It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Yeah, I'm him. I named the show after myself. Well, it used to be called Anti-War Radio. And before that, there was the Chaos Report and The Waste Is, the Best I Can Tell, and Say It Ain't So. That was the first one. Anyway, that was a long time ago now. Jeez. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show.
And, geez, I guess I hate to do this, but maybe some of you want to hear me talk about politics? Talk about politics for just one segment here, I think. Don't worry, it's not going to be about Rand Paul. Carson is now in first place. So I don't expect that to last because, he doesn't have much going for him. Certainly not zillions of dollars. But it does seem to indicate a weakening of Donald Trump's position. So that's interesting. The other interesting thing is that everybody else is disqualified basically without even thinking about it. I mean, what the Republicans like about Trump, the Republican voters, I mean, hey, here's a guy who has flip-flopped on every one of their most important issues, including abortion and guns and socialized health care and all these things, but they believe him when he says he hates Mexicans as much as them. That's really what the support comes down to there, you know? So, hard to believe that Cruz or Rubio stand a chance. I don't know about Cruz. Rubio, I assume, is Catholic just because he has a vowel at the end of his name. I'm not saying I disapprove of Catholicism any more or less than any other religion. I'm just saying conservative American Republicans do. And the American South is not going to give the Republican nomination to Rubio. And I very much doubt Cruz. Although, I don't actually know if he's Catholic, but I guess I assume he is. Sorry, but I just think that, mostly... Look, they stayed home for Mitt Romney because he's a Mormon. Everything else about him, they had a man, whatever, they can support him. They just didn't come out to support him because they can't stand his religion. They can't stand having a different one. Yeah, I guess that makes me a jerk for saying that they're all such jerks, but yeah, that's what I think. So, I think Rubio and Cruz, you can just count them out for that reason. Rand, his name is Paul, so no matter how bad he panders, nobody's buying what he's selling out. Nobody cares. Nobody wants in. So, he's done anyway. He should quit now. It's a disgrace, really, is what it is. And then Fiorina, she's going to keep running because she's running for vice president. So she'll stay in there for a while. But basically, it's still down. Everybody else is window dressing. Kasich and whoever else I'm forgetting. I mean, they might as well all quit now. It still comes down to Trump, who has his own money, versus Bush, who has the establishment. But the problem with Bush is he's worse than anyone could have possibly predicted. He's so bad at this. It's just ridiculous. He was over there whining the other day. Well, if everybody's going to be calling each other names, and maybe I got a lot of other better things that I could do than be president. He sounded like Eric Cartman crying he's going home. Seriously, did you see the clip of it? I should have got the clip of it. Well, he wants to demonize me, and then I'm expected to demonize him. I don't want to play. Jeb Bush. He has none of the strengths of George W. Bush. And, of course, the only strength that George Bush had was he could reasonably imitate a regular person from Texas, sorta, kinda, in a way that people believed in that, you know? He seemed enough like a regular guy, he passed what they call the beer test. Do you like him or do you not like him? And Jeb, his eyes don't never smile, just his mouth, because he ain't happy, you know? He's such a weirdo, man. I love it. I love watching Donald Trump don't give a damn. And all the horrible things that he says about Jeb is just great. And all the fun that he's making of W and putting Jeb in the position of having to try to defend W. And he just can't. Because how's he supposed to? It's indefensible, all of it. And so, just watching Trump ruin Jeb's life. And Jeb, he can't quit because he's the establishment's last hope. He can fuss all he wants, but he's not allowed to drop out, you know? And anyway, so I don't know what's going to happen, man. I guess, gun to my head, I have to say, I still think it's going to be Jeb. I still think that ultimately Trump will play the ringer and come to the establishment center. I think the Republican voters will too. They may hate Jeb, but they're going to say, listen, whoever we nominate has got to be able to beat Hillary. And that means he's got to be a rhino. He's got to be a so-called liberal Republican, centrist, extremist, so-called moderate. And that's how you win the general. You gotta pick the most moderate swing vote getting person or you're out. And Jeb, he's from Florida. And they got electoral votes, man. And that's the way the game is played. So it could be that Trump, the ideological candidate, really does, through sheer force of his winning personality and his independent billions of dollars, could get the nomination, but that would be a recipe for a Goldwater-style massacre, a complete and total landslide for the Democrat in the general. And I guess the same could be said about Sanders. You know, in 2007, it was very, very clear that Kucinich and Gravel were the decent human beings, the actual human beings up there on the Democrat side. And the other three, what's his name, the pretty boy, Breck hair guy, what was his name? John Edwards, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton, they were the clones. They were the establishment center. And any one of those three were good enough for the establishment. Obama was just Hillary in drag. That was it. And it was so obvious. Now, with Sanders, he kind of is splitting the difference between being, he basically is Obama, but with more of a Kucinich-y sales pitch. But I just don't know how successful he's been at consolidating Democratic Party power. I have to assume he has not been very good at it. And that Hillary Clinton's ground game, she must have learned from her massive failure betting everything on Super Tuesday last time and all of that, that, you know, the Clintons, they got a lot of money, they got a lot of connections and a lot of experience at this. And could Sanders somehow just sweep the left masses of America, the liberal masses of America, into the primaries and caucuses to get the nomination? I doubt it. I do think that Hillary's got the general the nomination locked up. But I think if it's her versus Jeb, I think Jeb will win. Although it's really a contest. See, people hate her more. But just, I don't think people hate Jeb, but they just don't like him and they just can't. I don't know if there's really any actual feeling for Hillary as much as God help us, save us from the Republicans kind of a thing. But Jeb is just so horrible. I don't think there's any way that you could underestimate his ability to fail at this. He is just such a parody of a Bush, isn't he? He's just ridiculous. And in every poll, in every state, and across the country, nationwide, he's got no traction whatsoever. Still very early on. And again, he's got the banks, the military-industrial complex, Israel, and the pharmaceutical companies, and everybody all locked up, agribusiness. So he ain't going nowhere yet. We'll see. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show, wrapping up for the day here. Man, oh man, check out the spotlight on antiwar.com tomorrow. I mean, not to sell whoever short. Wait, who am I selling short today? Oh, Coburn. Gotta go read Coburn today. Benghazi, Hillary is guilty, but not as charged. The great Patrick Coburn. But no, man, tomorrow's spotlight, it's at the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, thebulletin.org. The Okinawa missiles of October. Holy crap. So check it out. I'm going to try to get the guy on the show to tell you this story tomorrow, but I'm going to tell you right now because I can't help it. So what happened was, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, orders went to Okinawa to launch your nuclear missiles. Not just at Russia, but at Beijing, Hanoi, Pyongyang, and start a world nuclear war. And the code came in, and the code came in, and they double-checked it, and it was right. And the captain said, well, wait a minute, and had all these problems with it. Like, why are we immediately attacking China and Vietnam and North Korea that are non-belligerent countries in this? If we're having a war, wouldn't we just be attacking Russia? And I don't know. And there's some other things that make them scared. You sure you want me to do? They double-checked. Are you sure that that account goes through? How come they skipped DEFCON 1? How come they went from DEFCON 2 to launch the missiles? Maybe it was a preemptive strike against us here at Okinawa, and yet we haven't been exploded yet. So that must not be it. And I don't know, but the problem was the highest ranking guy there was a captain in charge of the nuclear missiles, and the orders were coming down from a major. And one of the guys in charge of one of the groups of missiles said, hey, you're just a captain, and you're not going to overrule me following my orders from the major. My orders are to launch these missiles at Russia. And the captain then supposedly sent two armed men. If this guy tries to launch his missiles, you shoot him dead first. Not until I say so. Because I'm not believing that these orders are right. This can't be right. So they triple-checked and said, you know what, damn it, either tell us to go to DEFCON 1 or send us a stand-down order. What the hell is going on? And then they finally got back a code that said, oh, yeah, no, don't nuke Russia. Oops. Oops. The captain was about to shoot the lieutenant. Because the lieutenant was about to nuke the USSR. Oh, I'm sorry. Slight nuclear snafu there. Didn't mean to tell you to destroy civilization and maybe all of humanity forever. I mean, this is at the height of the Cold War when each side had tens of thousands of nukes. For God's sake. And now here's the thing about this story. I guess I should have said at the beginning. It's based on one source. Actually, no, it's based on two. It's based on one named source and another confidential source who confirmed it but didn't want to be named. However, hey, good enough for New York Times work, if not, you know, world-class historianship. Is that a word? Did I just coin it? So, yeah, it's good enough for me. But at the bottom, it has a note from Daniel Ellsberg, who says to the Bulletin, I strongly urge you to publish this thing. Though tentative, the way it's written, it's carefully hedged. The parts of it that are not certain are labeled as so. It's very well and carefully written. And it should lead to congressional hearings, a disclosure of documents, and the truth to come forward. Humanity deserves to know the truth of this history if it's true. Let's have it. Wow. And then, good, I still have time. TheBulletin.org writes in a little appended paragraph below Ellsberg's, below this piece, The Okinawa Missiles of October.
During the same period, Bruce Blair, a research scholar at Princeton University's Program on Science and Global Security, also wrote an email message to the Bulletin. This is the entirety of the message. Quote, Aaron Tovish, that's the author of the article, asked me to weigh in with you if I believe his piece should be published in the Bulletin, or for that matter, any outlet. I do believe it should be, even though it has not been fully verified at this stage. It strikes me that a first-hand account from a credible source in the launch crew itself goes a long way toward establishing the plausibility of the account. It also strikes me as a plausible sequence of events based on my knowledge of nuclear command and control procedures during the period and later. Frankly, it's not surprising to me either that a launch order would be inadvertently transmitted to nuclear launch crews. It's happened a number of times to my knowledge, and probably more times than I know. Sorry, I mispronounced either there. I put the emphasis wrong because I thought it was the kind of either that was going to distinguish between two things coming up, but actually it was just the one next thing. A failure of inflection on my part. I apologize. Frankly, it's not surprising to me either that a launch order would be inadvertently transmitted to nuclear launch crews. It's happened a number of times to my knowledge and probably more times than I know. It happened at the time of the 1967 Middle East War when an aircraft nuclear aircraft crew, a carrier nuclear aircraft crew was sent on an actual attack order instead of an exercise training nuclear order. It happened in the early 1970s when what was the order to nuke Cairo? Jesus Christ. It happened at the time of the 67 war. I already said that. It happened in the early 1970s when the Strategic Air Command Omaha retransmitted an exercise launch order as an actual real world launch order. I can vouch for this one personally since the snafu was briefed to Minutemen launch crews soon thereafter. In both of these incidents, the code check, sealed authenticators in the first incident, and message format validation in the second failed, unlike the incident recounted by the launch crew member in Aaron's article. But you get the drift here. It wasn't just that rare for these kinds of snafus to occur. One last item to reinforce the point. The closest the U.S. came to an inadvertent strategic launch decision by the president happened in 1979 when a NORAD early warning training tape depicting a full-scale Soviet strategic strike inadvertently coursed through the actual early warning network. National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski was called twice in the night and told the U.S. was under nuclear attack. And he was just picking up the phone to persuade President Carter that a full-scale response needed to be authorized right away when a third call told him it was a false alarm. I guess that may be the closest on an accident on the American side. But there are at least 20 of these. Just Google that up, man. I had that somewhere. Let's see. I still have time. He said, this is why I urge you to publish it, because this kind of thing is real, and people need to know this. And we are talking about, hey, once somebody nukes Moscow, or somebody nukes D.C., what do you think, they're going to sit there and take it? And not nuke back? And then, you know, Russia doesn't have the allies they used to have, but America does, and that's still a lot of targets. Full-scale nuclear war? Over a bunch of pigs. I mean, who are we talking about here in charge of this? You know, you imagine from movies that it's, you know, the American James Bonds and the most capable and honorable men are running things here. The military, Harry Brown used to say, is just the post office with M16s. On their best day, they're completely incompetent boobs when they're not psychopathic, deliberate mass murderers and war criminals. You know, trust them with hydrogen bombs? With hydrogen bombs. Some of them into the tens of megatons in power. Really? I just don't think that's a good idea. There, I said it.
All right. See you guys tomorrow.